I'm Gwen Edwardson. Today is October 14th, 2005, and we're at UAF, the Walsh Hall. I was wondering about like economics.
Here in Alaska, or
like how you guys were brought up, like economically, where you guys have to rely a lot on money, and was it?
During the time I was small, I guess really, since it was during the Depression, there really wasn't that much money around. I mean, there were no jobs. Everybody was trying to basically live off the land, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we grew a lot of our own stuff. We put up a lot of, you know, like salmon and various ways of drying, canning, and smoking. And as young kids at that time, used to help our grandparents, our parents, you know, in the processing of all of this food that we were going to have during the winter.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't that, and then, you know, wood gathering and all that stuff too. We had oil stoves in the village that I came from, but we leaned more toward the wood because of economics, you know, because oil was pretty expensive then.
Mm-hmm.
For people that don't have jobs or anything like that. But so a lot of those people had to rely almost totally on wood for heat and cooking. So all through our childhood life, you know, that was kind of the basis, the way we lived as far as economics. Because we didn't have that much help from the government or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the village I lived in was pretty much self-reliant. They had their own cannery. They had their own, that was it, really, when I was small. It was just the cannery. And everybody worked there. It was just a seasonal job, so you only worked during the summer. And that was the source of a lot of our cash income. Wasn't a lot much either. So because of that, we had to do a lot of the summer preparation for the winter.
Yeah. It was locally owned?
Yeah, it was owned by the village.
Okay.
And they had their own power plant. And it was well ahead of, I think, of a lot of what was going on up here in the interior, above the Yukon and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they weren't in the way of commerce like we were.
Yeah.
And we weren't there with, you know, flow of commerce from down the lower 48 through southeast Alaska, Ketchikan, Juneau, and other places, was, you know, Sitka, pretty prevalent.
Yeah.
And so that was our, let's say, where we learned a lot of what we knew about commerce. And a lot of us dealt with it because, you know, we were fishermen, you know, it's a business, and you run it like a business.
Mm-hmm.
So we learn a lot about that, you know, the actual, you know, capitalist, you know.
Yeah.
Learn a lot about that. Well, so we pretty much were in that all the time when I grew up. So, like I said, we had running water, sewer, and all the utilities. It's still that way today, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up with that. I didn't have to, you know, live like I was. Only time we lived
out camping.
Yeah, I was out camping when we had outhouses like that. We had a hall of water. We had a wood and in the camp. So a lot of that kind of experience was during the fish process, gathering and all that. And there was a lot of that, you know. We depended heavily on that. Getting all that food together. usually, people were pretty good about that. They knew how much, they knew how to gauge how much they needed for the winter,
yeah.
You know, in conjunction with the little bit of money that they made in the summertime. Seasonal work. But as the year, like, after I got out, in fact, as I was going through high school, I had to pay for my own high school education from the proceeds I got from the fishing.
Yeah.
And so, it wasn't, because of what, I went to SJ and they required tuition and all that stuff, and I bought your own books and things like that. Well, Mount Edgecombe was a government-sponsored high school, so the kids that went there didn't have to pay for anything. And that was helpful to me, because now I'm living in the modern culture right now, really, during that time, so I'm learning all that stuff,
yeah.
You know, how to cope in that kind of environment, economically and socially and things like that. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And, so it wasn't a difficult time for me. In fact, it wasn't any problem at all when I went to school outside on the lower 48.
Yeah.
Cause it's, the lifestyle was pretty much that way for me anyway, and all of this had lived in Metro County.
Mm-hmm.
But like I say, when I went to school down in the lower 48, along with a lot of the kids that were from up here and then above the Yukon, I could see there they were having a difficult time. And there had to be adjustments by the BIA for them, for those kind of students that come down to Lower 48 like that, to go through some kind of an orientation program to adapt them.
Yeah.
Like they stop off in Seattle and maybe spend a month there and get used to city life.
Yeah.
Buses and traffic and lights and all that stuff and shopping centers and all that stuff. So it's an awesome change for a lot of kids, even now.
Yeah.
For them to come out of the village and go all the way down there and have to live like that. It takes time to adjust.
Yeah. From low place to high place.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So even, like I said, even now it's happening. Back then, when I was in the war, it was more pronounced. You know, some of the kids got homesick real bad. Didn't want to participate. They wanted to come home. My wife talking about that when she went to Wrangell. That was a big shock, culture shock to her, from Mentor, old Mentor to Wrangell, even now, because see the Wrangell was a big, was in the way of commerce, so they developed in the modern culture, right, as things came along.
Yeah.
And she would tell me stories about that, I said, it never really bothered me. It was only momentarily, so to speak. Like we went to Haynes' house, it wasn't really a shock at all.
Yeah.
In fact, I looked at his letter like it was an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
For me personally. And most of our, we used to trade among ourselves as kids, in the mission. We start using food that we got in the mission, and like toast and desserts for like money.
Yeah.
So we trade, I'll give you a week's amount of toast for, say, a bag of marbles or something like that,
Yeah.
So it was kind of our own little way of bartering, sort of, a little bit of our own commerce.
Yeah.
So that went on a lot among the kids, I remember that. But that's, But then later on, like when I went to school, after I grew up and got married and went to Los Angeles, I went down there for, I don't know, 22 months, I think. Four of those months was, I took some math and English courses prior to the start of the electronic course. And we broke into the basics of electronics. And, you know, this was a course in industrial electronics. We touched on a lot of different parts of electronics, radio, TV, transmitters, a lot of logic, later came in handy in the computers nowadays. But we went through all the technology changes, like vacuum tubes, the solid state, the transistors, and then to micro-miniature, like they have today. So that was really interesting. A lot of fun.
Did you guys have like a lot of tourists? Or was that like later?
Tourists were?
In Metlakatla?
We did, yeah. My mother, I remember that as a child. My mother used to make a lot of like moccasins and necklaces, little dolls, little native dolls. I remember those vividly, because while she was doing that, the reason I remember it so clearly is she used to tell us stories while she's sewing.
Really?
Yeah. And, I was real young then. I remember started early, kindergarten, first grade level. And she traded a lot of this stuff with the tourists that came on these big ships. They didn't have regular tourist ships back then. There was something that, people toured, but they went along on these more like commercial ships.
Yeah.
They used them for freighting and stuff like that, but they also had people come aboard to tour Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of, come down the docks, and she would sell a lot of those things that she made.
Mostly during the summer? Or?
Yeah.
What kind of stories did she tell?
Pardon?
Like real stories she would tell you? Like when she was
selling? I don't remember. I don't really remember. But she, a lot of them were like, things that we were having in school. Or she would read out of a book, like Dick and Jane, and the things you had in kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. I think later on it was like Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, In fact, in the Haynes house, they used to read to us every night, a chapter, and a lot of they'd pick out a story. And again, a lot of most of those were like Huckleberry. We used to like those Huckleberry, Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn, Taylor's. And then after lights out, the dorm mate would stand in the hall and read to us out in the hall. So all the dorm rooms could hear her. The lights out, and the imagination just went out of the way. Follow along with the story.
And you said something about the power plant. Was that from the water?
Yeah, hydroelectric power. We had a big lake in the mountains, right about Metlakatla. Did I show you the picture?
Yeah.
Okay. And that was our main source of water, and that was the falls that came down and drove our power plant, hydroelectric power. And that was that way for a lot of years. And then finally, the town grew so much that the power plant was too small, so they went to another lake and drilled a tunnel up underneath the lake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then the water came down that and that tunnel and that drilled the hydroelectric generators.
Was that year then?
Oh, yeah, 24 hours, 365 days a year.
Wow.
And that was our main source, and we had it later on as the electrical requirements grew, you know, we had to add diesel power to supplement the hydroelectric power as the time grew.
Yeah.
That's the way it is right now. That's all owned by the village. And it's been that way for as long as I was there, you know, way before I was born.
Mm-hmm.
And the people went to school and learned that, you know, like became electricians and able to operate and maintain
mm-hmm.
those power plants and the local people.
Yeah.
I had an uncle that did that. A couple of uncles that did that. And had a father-in-law that did that for quite a few years. In fact, later on, my father became mayor of the town, and then he ran the power plant organization called Little Cattle Power Mart.
Yeah.
He managed it for a lot of years. Prior to becoming mayor, and then even during the time as a mayor.
Would you sell anything, like, to help, like, to go to school or just have extra money?
I didn't, no. All my money was made from fishing. Commercial fishing on my dad's boat.
Mm-hmm.
And so I funded all my 4 years of high school.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't all that much, but man, it was a lot of money back then. I mean, by today's time, you know.
Yeah.
I remember it was, first year was $207 for the whole year.
Wow.
Man, that almost took all of what I made. I didn't get full share until I was 16 years old. So I didn't get paid all that much.
Mm-hmm.
And top it off, fishing wasn't all that big either back then. The fishing industry was pretty well depleted.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, looking back on it, it's just poor management of the resource. Later on, just before I went to school, I had to make a decision whether I wanted to be a fisherman or go to school. And all my grandparents and parents were trying to get this kid to continue on with their school,
mm-hmm.
some kind of trade or something. That's what I did. I went to a trade school. Flip of a coin.
Really?
Yeah. That's how I decided that, because I wanted to be a fisherman. I just loved the game. Born and raised in it, and my dad's a prominent fisherman. And,
mm-hmm.
and later on, he's... Well, you can see that when you watch that tape.
Mm-hmm.
Were you there yesterday?
Yeah.
Okay. He rose to really high in the village of prominence. And, mm-hmm. You know, he was a magistrate at one time, a council member. He was looked to for a lot of technical advice, you know, like boat building, engine work. And, you know, it was, you know, when you become a fisherman, become a jack of a lot of different trades. It just has to be that way in order for you to make money and keep costs low. You do a lot of your own work. That's what he did. He taught himself how to do all of these things.
Wow.
Pretty much on his own. And that's the way I did it.
That's awesome.
And pretty much following the list and stuff.
He learned it on his own?
Yeah, much of it, yeah, most of it.
Wow. Awesome. How about the herring? Like, did you guys do the herring eggs and stuff?
Yeah, we commercially fish herring, both gill netting and purse seine. I'm pretty much out of it, you know, most of that, during those two fisheries. And I didn't, I participated in the herring in Bristol Bay while I was working out here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I ran a boat out there during the season. It was like April through early part of June, or the latter part of April. It wasn't very long. Herring were not a lot, around that not long, you know, they just come. Maybe at the week at the most, you know, that you'll be fishing it. So it was a very, very short season for him. Salmon is also now. Starting in July, about September, and then go down to Puget Sound by the end of September, and up into October. Used to wind the salmon season, but then a lot of the guys now are engaged in several types of fisheries, as well as the salmon, halibut, and codfish, and sea cucumber. They dive for that now, which they didn't have in that industry when I was fishing as a boy. But mostly sea cucumber. And abalone, and a lot of the shell-cut fish that are on the rocks way down deep, they dive for that. Yeah, so they had to teach a lot of those younger people how to dive. It's a pretty dangerous occupation. You heard about the bends. If you come up too fast, you know, from deep water. Just like your blood would boil. It could kill you.
Wow.
And so they have to come up very slowly, in stages, come back up to the surface.
Wow.
And you get down to about 20, 30 feet down, and then you have to do this decompression sequence. And it may take half hour, you know, 45 minutes when you come up there. Allow your blood to adjust to that pressure that you're under. And the danger is like in those boats when they anchor out and the tide's moving fast, you usually try to anchor up around a rock because there's a lot of, maybe top of the rock maybe 20, 30 feet down, but the bottom, the base of the rock pile, big rock on maybe 50 feet down the bottom, and work around. And they're on a big cable with air hoses going down into your headgear.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have tanks. The boat that they work off of has all the air compressors on them and supply the lines going down to and the electronic communications. As we talk to those guys down here.
Okay.
And, so, the guy that's working the deck has to know, when the guys, you normally don't work them maybe a half hour to an hour at the most.
What are they catching down there?
Sea cucumbers. And there's a spiny looking thing that, I'm trying to remember the name of it. That's another one they died for. It looked like a ball with spines on it, that were like porcupine quills.
Yeah.
About 3 or 4 inches long. All over it, you know.
Okay.
That's the way those things travel. They're just like legs, and they keep rolling and rolling. Or they ride the tides. Same way with these sea cucumbers. They can't swim by on their own. They rely on the tidal movements.
Okay.
The tide going back and forth. They
yeah.
just roll around. Yeah?
And how do you guys like cut them up or?
Yeah, well, we take down these great big sacks or like dip nets.
Mm-hmm.
You take them down, they're real long, and you fill them up as you go along, you fill them up, and they all work toward the back, and you know, fill the whole sock up. And then you take them up, and you tell the guy up there, okay, you got a load here.
Yeah.
You got a line attached to that. It's a big rim like that with a big long sock
mm-hmm.
made out of a net. You fill that up and pull it up onto the boat.
After they bring them up, what do you guys, like, how do you guys preserve
they
them?
They take them to the cold storage and they process it there. Mm-hmm. And I don't know the details of how they do that, you know. You have to slice them over because the inside of the sea cucumber is nothing but water.
Yeah.
The live portion of it's on the outer, you know, like the skin,
mm-hmm.
and there's only about maybe a finger thickness of meat all the way around it.
Mm-hmm.
And they get about that big around, they get about that long. They look like a cucumber, got all these warty looking things on their butt,
yeah.
body, and don't look like they're alive, but if they are, they move.
Mm-hmm.
And
Do they taste good?
I don't know. I haven't had them.
Yeah.
I may have, but I don't remember. Because I remember we used to get them out in some of these camps we'd go out to.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to fry it. But I just don't remember how it tastes. You know, it's the last time I ever had it. It was when I was a little boy. And finally they turned commercial was not too long ago. Just, I would say it's been in the last 10 or 15 years
mm-hmm.
that they commercialized it.
Okay.
And now the younger people, they're doing all the fishing now. And a lot of these guys that fish in the summertime were, they usually do this in, you know, like in early spring.
Okay.
Before the salmon season starts. A couple months before, 3 months before. And so this all these new fisheries like that didn't develop until after I got out of it. I've been up here all these years, about 30, 40 years I've been up here.
Yeah.
And then, so I'm not that familiar with, the only one I'm really familiar with halibut fishing because I was used quite a bit when I was a boy
mm-hmm.
in salmon. And even then, we didn't have gill netters in our village at that time. Just all purse seiners. Now they got most of the fleet down there is our gill netters, and this purse seiner they diminished. You know, just too costly. You know, they're big boats.
Yeah.
Like I showed you.
Yeah.
And it's the cost, expensive operating is. With them, you know, and you have to put in a lot of fish to you know, make enough money out of it.
Yeah.
You know, support the family.
Do those fish, when you get the fish, do they go through the process too?
Yeah, they take them to the canneries and they either can them or now they're freezing them.
Mm-hmm.
So what you see a lot of, you know, the frozen fish in the markets. Well, you kind of,
mm-hmm.
when I was a boy, canning was all they did.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't freeze or, you know,
mm-hmm.
process it any other way. And it's kind of a recent development. instead of doing other processes. They freeze, probably like a 50-50 now. See, the canning market kind of diminished. The fresh frozen kind of replaced a lot of that cans. So that's where most of the market is now, is the fresh frozen.
So when you guys catch them, you get them into the can ring. Can you just exchange it for money?
Well, they have an accounting server so that they say, okay, you count the fish, or they weigh it now. They used to count a long time ago, and as little boy, they counted the fish individually and paid you accordingly based on the number of fish you caught. So if you caught, in the summertime, if you caught 150,000 fish, they give you $3 a fish or something like that. You figure that out. But you got to divide that all up on the crew members. You got to share for the gear and a share for the boat. It's split up about 15, 16 different ways. But now they handled by the pound now, so they weren't handled by the fish anymore, which is better, There's sometimes during the season, fish are varying in size. They may be large at the beginning, and mediocre in the middle, and small at the end, depending on what species you're fishing for. You fish with all the different species down there. And they're priced differently too. Each species. The sockeye being the favorite. They command the highest prices.
Would you guys like keep for you guys, for yourself?
We make sure we have a lot of fish that is going to last us for the winter, out of wooden kits. There's not much, 30, 40 fish, 50 fish.
And you guys would can them yourself?
Or we could arrange with the canning, or we just buy it off the canner, because they give us a pretty darn good discount. What other subject
do you do? Do you like big animals besides fishing?
Deer is probably the biggest animal. And they're not very big. I would say dressed up, when you dress out a deer, it's probably something less than 100 pounds of deer meat. They're not very big.
They're smaller than caribou?
Yeah, they're very small, because it's probably half the size. So yeah, we got to get a lot of, and there are a lot of deer down there. We can't, I thought they would dry it, but I don't remember ever having that. They might have done it, I don't know. But I just don't recall it happening when I was born. Most of it's canned, jarred.
Like, you guys would cut them up and just... How would you guys can them?
The jar, most of it's jarred. It's curd jars or mason jars. We'd either have it cut up in chunks in gravy, jar that way, or just leave it. I used to like that one of the gravy, because my aunt, especially my aunt, she used to put curry in that one. I loved it. And we serve it on rice or potatoes. And,
Yeah.
That's why we have ours. Or that's why we have caribou.
Mm-hmm.
Gravy and rice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is that, you guys would just catch them in the summer?
They're usually in the fall or winter. Yeah. It's most of the summer season is dedicated. You run into deer, you'll get it, you know.
Yeah.
On the fishing ground. Yeah. And I used to shoot quite a few of them fishing. But we eat it right on the boat. And, we'll take home whatever's left over the water. Used by the crew. We used to have about 8 people on the boat, on that boat that size.
Yeah.
You don't need that many today because you just get the power box to do all the pulling around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe we just kind of guide it before it was about breaking work. And back then we had as high as 10 people on the boat. It was a different style of fishing. We didn't have the power box back then. Those came along maybe, I would say, in the 60s, late 50s, 60s. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the only thing they use because it's a lot easier than they use. Mm-hmm. Cut down on the number of people they need, down to maybe 5. You can operate with 5 people on board now, 6 people, usually. So the cost is reduced quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Were you there for the, did you guys have an effect on the 64, that earthquake?
I was up here.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, I never thought to ask about it, you know, how it affected them down there.
Mm-hmm.
But up here, it was where was I? I was downtown.
Really?
Yeah, geez, I got scared. I ran out in the street, you know, just, you know, 2nd Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
Went into a store to get some pot. While I was in there, they were being served, and things started falling down. My wife was telling me she was in the hospital having a baby, you know, from her first husband.
Uh-huh.
Down in Anchorage, and that's where it was bad.
Yeah.
She said that she thought that old hospital was going to fall now.
Holy.
She was way up in the upper floors. You know. Yeah, everybody went downtown, ran out in the streets. Things are falling down. You can see pieces of the building fall off.
Mm-hmm.
But then another year, I was out at work. We had a lot of, maybe back in the 60s. In the 70s, we had some pretty big earthquakes. And we were just getting ready to get off work. And some of the guys were arriving early. They were going to relieve us. And I was sitting on a little roller stool. You sit on the work and stuff cooking down low. I was just reaching over to pick up a tool and be ready to put my tools away.
Mm-hmm.
And that thing started going out. And you hear the cabins, all the equipment cabins, they're big like that refrigerator,
uh-huh.
But maybe 3 or 4 feet tall, just clanging together. And we had a antenna console. And we had something here. I don't know what it was. I forgot what it was. Back and forth. We were right in the middle of the pass too, and we didn't know what to do, and we just sat there and thought, you know, we couldn't leave our stations.
Mm-hmm.
we're right in the middle of the past.
I think so.